Welcome to Veterans Connected, where maintenance and reliability expert and military veteran Eric Bevavino connects with fellow veterans in industry during each episode, where they exchange their experiences and discuss the transition from the military to industry and the paths and resources that led them to where they are today. The Veterans Connected podcast is proudly produced by the industry's leading network and learning community, Mobius Connect. Eric, over to you.
Hi, I'm Eric Bevavito, host of the Mobius Connect podcast focused on connecting military veterans to the maintenance and reliability community. Our aim here is to bridge the understanding gap between the military and civilian worlds, thereby improving the veteran transition experience and ultimately providing hope and a helping hand to any of our brothers and sisters out there struggling to find their way. We'll do this by interviewing veterans who have successfully made it through. For this session, we've chosen to interview one such Navy veteran, Jeff Gibson, whose fascinating and patriotic story is a must-listen for anyone interested in joining us on this mission. Hey, Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, no problem. I've been looking forward to this since our time together. We worked together in my last corporate position, and I was really excited about the cool tool that y'all have built to help transition vets as well as those looking to hire them. And I think this will be a really, really high value episode for all our listeners.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Why don't we start with who you are and what you do today, and then maybe we'll dial it back to the early years.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. So Jeff Gibson, I'm the COO of Opline. Opline is a labor data intelligence company that allows us to automatically match any candidate with skills to all the jobs in North America. You know, basically we do this by collecting massive amounts of labor demand jobs out in, you know, every company posts their jobs out on their career pages, and every night we go scoop all that up. And then that allows us to kind of value anybody against all that set of jobs. So we offer that technology to specifically focus on military hiring, you know. So we provide a tool to any company who has expressed interest or would like to improve or kind of, upgrade their military veteran hiring programs, you know. And then simultaneously, we give that tool to, you know, anybody in the military community that, wants to kind of, be smarter about their job search instead of just, working harder type thing.
Yeah, I think it's really great. And in a nutshell, if I could chime in here a little bit, you guys have really taken, I would say, the understanding gap between perhaps non-veteran HR personnel or organizations that have to interpret military type resumes, right, and link them to job requirements, job requests, job fulfillment requests, the demand signal coming from the business, right, and really doing that translation and connecting for them by taking the military member's service record, MOS, or, designator in the Navy, right, or specialty, and then linking that through digital tools with the job requirements of what's been posted out there. So I think it's really fascinating how you guys have been able to use the technology. To me, it's fascinating. You've been able to use the technology to do it. I mean, small company, built veterans who have unique perspective, some special forces guys. So, I mean, here's a stereotype. You know, you guys aren't just, muddy knuckle draggers, coming out of the dirt with blood on your uniforms, right? You're like on the, not to use a bad analogy here, but on the bleeding edge of technology to help other veterans and to cross this chasm of transition, which will also help out American businesses and America in general, right? Yeah. By getting folks with leadership experience into roles that they can thrive in. So How did your career in the military start? Where were you from originally, and what got you interested in going into the military?
Yeah, so I born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri, and then had to pay for my own college, so it was natural for me to go to the state college. So I went to Mizzou, University of Missouri in Columbia, and then to help pay for school, I was on that high school college tour, and we walked by the ROTC building, and I think the tour guide said something like, "Hey, I don't know what they do. They wear a uniform once a week, but I think they get their school paid for." So I ended up at the end of that tour going back and walking into that building, and in hindsight, probably one of the few very smart moves I ever did. So I ended up becoming a Navy ROTC student at Mizzou, and then get introduced to the Navy. First time I was ever in an airplane. First time I remember seeing the ocean. Was in doing one of those midshipman cruises, where they send you,
sure,
4 weeks, yeah, out, so, but, so doing that, I ended up, when I first got in, I was like, oh, I think the movie Top Gun just came out. So everybody was going to be a pilot, went through all that, processing, screening, and, got the green light to be a pilot. But I did one of those midshipman cruises out in San Diego between my junior and senior year. And then we got a tour of this Navy SEAL training compound out there. One of my midshipmen guys I was working with was a Texas A&M guy. And I think, he had a cousin or a brother who was out there. So we went over there and got a tour, and I was just blown away. I'm like, holy cow, what is this? And can I do it? So
Coronado, right?
Yep. Coronado. So then I, ran back to my Navy ROTC unit, like, hey, I want to do this. And they're like, oh, well, you can't be a pilot then. You got to apply. But we've never had anybody from this school ever go straight into SEAL training.
Interesting.
Like,
okay.
Yeah. So they didn't really know how to kind of like put the packet together, the instructions.
Right.
When I submitted my application, it was, SEAL, diver, and other, depending on, and then the Navy picks which one you go. And then when it came back, I got diver, and at the time I'm like, huh, what's diver? Not really knowing that. And again, my ROTC unit really didn't know either. But that turned out to be great. It was phenomenal. I mean, went to a surface warfare officer school first in Newport, Rhode Island, and then I went to dive school. I thought it was phenomenal. It was great. I mean, spent probably 9 months there, doing the basic diving officer course, and then the salvage, and then the ship I was going to had some special capability with, I did the helium oxygen, course. Yeah.
What, just out of curiosity, what class were you in there?
Yeah. 8930 BDO. Yeah, 89.
Okay. I was 9040. So, I mean, I'm just sort of chuckling to myself because we grew up in the same sort of time frame, and Top Gun was, a big deal.
Yeah.
And once I figured out my eyes weren't good enough to be a pilot. And I also, you probably took the aptitude test, spatial aptitudes upside down and sideways. And I couldn't make head nor tails of that. So I came by it a little bit by accident as well. So that's great. So Penn State ROTC, your Mizzou ROTC.
Oh, yeah.
So that, these are, it may be interesting to our listeners that, we knew each other, acquaintances, right? But I didn't know it in this depth. So this is really fun for me to hear about this. So, well, great. So you went to, either a sub tender or a sub rescue ship or maybe just regular tender or.
Yeah. I went to the USS Sunbird, a submarine rescue ship out of Groton, Connecticut.
Oh, right.
And okay. I kind of joke, I like to refer to it as the mighty warship Sunbird, because it's not, Sunbird's not very, you know, manly name, bold, you know, it's not like
right.
Resolute or Avenger or, you know, just something.
Right on, right on. So Groton, Connecticut, and those were probably the ships that, I don't know if the sort of really deep diving, saturation diving type of stuff was going on while you were there, but maybe.
Yeah, one of our main missions was to tow the NR1. Remember that one, the nuclear research vessel? Yeah, but that thing, when I got there, I never saw it. It was up in, you know, the shipyards, you know, 2 year overhaul. You know,
okay, so, yeah,
yeah. But so ironically, our ship main mission was to support SEAL training operations off Virginia coast.
You
know,
okay,
they would, you know. You know, do the SDV operations, the SEAL delivery vehicle operations, and do the, you know, lock in, lock out. So they always needed to have a surface chamber on board. So we would act as a lookout, you know, for the submarine, and also be there in case for any diving accidents or anything. So that, you know, kind of got re-piqued my interest in being a SEAL, because I saw these guys working, you know, doing pretty cool stuff. I'm like, all right, I got to see what can I do to get back there. So because of that, I got exposed to like the commanding officer, SEAL Team 8, SDV Team 2, you know, talking to them. And they're like, no, dude, you can transfer. You get qualified on the ship. You can put a package in and get and transfer, you know, from the special operations community to the special warfare community. I'm like, really? And they're like, yeah. You know, and so they gave me all these tips. They wrote letters of recommendations. They even said, hey, when you get your packet, you should hand deliver it to DC, you know, go down there and hand deliver it to the detailer, you know? So, you know, the same office that the diving detailer there as well. So I did that, and I walked in, and, remember Margaret, who's the, she's like the little old lady in tennis shoes, like who ran the whole system.
Perhaps I remember having a detailer, with the last name of Gibson as well. I think he was a commander or a captain or something like that, as well as a gentleman named Rusty Myrick. But I don't remember Margaret. But yeah, there's always somebody behind the scenes or in front of the scenes that is making sure all the paperwork is correct, for sure.
Yeah, I think she was like the GS-12 or something that it kind of right, ran right. office. And, but also the continuity. I think she ended up being there like 45 years.
Crazy.
So I ended up handing my packet to the SEAL detailer, and, you know, he looked at it and then pulled a box out underneath his desk, you know, like a two by box, and tossed it in with probably 100 other ones. He's like, all right, we'll give you a call in a few months. You know, if you don't hear from us, sorry. I'm like, oh, okay. Is there anything else I can do? So luckily I got in. I got the green light to transfer, you know, because normally on any SEAL class, it'd be anywhere from like 25 to 30 officers per year. Okay. Naval Academy gets the majority of those. ROTC gets one or two. OCS gets one, you know, handful. And then anybody who, if there's any officers the prior year who don't make it, that opens up a billet for a transfer, lateral transfer person like me. So,
okay.
So I had to have a lot of things kind of lined up for that to happen.
Yeah, it was meant to be.
Cool. Yeah, that, it was funny. Yeah, when I started going through SEAL training, I had a picture of the Mighty Warship Sunbird, you know, in my, you know, right, you know, in my bathroom. So the first thing I saw in the morning, it's kind of motivation, you know.
Right. I want to be the guys doing the fun stuff. I don't want to be watching the guys doing the fun stuff. Yep. Yeah.
Exactly. And it reminded me like, hey, man, you're lucky you're here. You know, don't blow it, you know, kind of thing.
Perspective. Yeah, for sure. Perspective. You know, it was interesting. So I was on the Preserver out of Little Creek.
And
we didn't do many operations with the SEALs, but SDV launched because of the boom, heavy duty boom on the aft end of the ship. We could put these guys in, and it's one of my most interesting memories. I mean, we're talking wintertime, maybe February in Chesapeake Bay, and, you know, sending guys out to do, you know, a mission profile, and them coming back just freezing, right? It just wetsuits, right? Just wetsuits. So, you know, cold water diving is something that, at least at that point in time, which we're talking, I was active duty from 90 to 94. I mean, 30 years ago, right? So maybe it's gotten a little bit better. Maybe the suits have gotten better since, or maybe it's just a hard guy type of thing to do to, you know, get really, really cold when you go in the water. But that was interesting. All right. So you went out to Coronado and you did the deal and made it through
And then I got first SEAL team, SEAL Team 1 right there in Coronado, you know, basically just, you know, three buildings down at the time. You know, did a whole workup and deployment. And then from there, wanted to get out to the East Coast and switch. And I went to the STV Team 2, you know, command, you know, which, you know, kind of full circle, you know, type thing. But, you know, that entailed, you know, going to like a, you know, 4-month STV, you know, school to learn how to drive them. And then you report to the team, you know, so that was, in the STV, as you probably know, the STV teams, there isn't like a, you know, everybody wants to do those. You know, I actually, you know, one of the few people, I love diving, you know, I don't mind it at all. You know, most SEALs kind of hate it, you know? That STV tour was amazing, you know. It's a kick in the butt, you know, as we just talked, you know, those, you know, doing a 3-4-5 hour dive and, you know, 50 degree weather isn't unusual, you know. You know, did a, you know, full workup. We deployed to the Mediterranean, and then I ended up staying there and doing my operations tour as well. So
nice. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Diving, parachuting, fast roping. I mean, those are all means to get SEALs where they want to go, right? Having the diving background and perhaps more experience in diving, you know, proclivity. I mean, I'm leaning back towards the scuba community now in my second sort of adventure phase of life here. And it's something that sticks with you. So. Thank goodness for divers to make sure that the equipment's working all right and to help get everybody going where they're going. But
and each of the SV teams had a huge contingent of Navy divers whose whole job is to maintain the dry duck shelter that goes on top of the submarine. You know, it's very technically oriented. You know, diving heavy. You know, so it was a really unique team. You know, they have. You know, the blended specialties with SEALs and divers, and then all the technology that goes that wrapped around all that, you know, it's pretty impressive what they can do.
Yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Yeah, it's a great team effort. So you went to SDVs, and then did you do something after that? Or
now it's, you know, now that's probably my third tour, you know, one, two, three. Yeah. You know, fourth tour now in my progression as an officer, I had to do a staff tour, you know. So, back up to D.C., talking with Margaret, you know, the lady we talked about earlier, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
I just happened to be in the office when they got someone from London called and said, hey, I need a replacement for this SEAL officer in London who needs to, you know, rotate out. And she just like looks at me, is like, you want to go to London? And I'm like, yes. And I didn't even like, I didn't even call my wife or anything. I'm just like, yes. And I was like, you know, after she's like, okay, let me just get it confirmed and approved. And, you know, I'll let you know. So then on the way home, I called my wife and told her, hey, do you want to go to London? You know, so.
It's funny how those things work out.
Yeah.
I mean, the timing, you just happen to be there and you're your next guy in the breach. So, yeah, well, let's go to England. Why not? Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. So, yeah, I ended up doing a staff tour in London, which is, you know, it was at Cincus Navier, the commander in chief of U.S. Naval Forces Europe. You know, he's also co-had, he's also like the NATO commander for, you know, as well, which is kind of that's way more big deal than the Navy component. Command there. But that was my first introduction to kind of, you know, a staff to war. I called it like kind of the ghost of Navy future, you know, like, ooh, you know, as an officer, no more
Right.
operational tours, really. You know, my next tour would have been probably NXO, you know, then, you know, maybe some program job and then CEO, you know, it's just, you kind of saw like all the fun jobs were gone, you know.
So were you a lieutenant commander or a commander at that
Yeah, I went over
time?
there, lieutenant, and then right before leaving, you know, picked up 04, you know, kind of thing.
Gotcha.
But I ended up, it was kind of strange too. A majority of that staff are, you know, lieutenants, junior lieutenants who are getting out, you know. So that kind of gave that, you know, I don't know if it's, you know, suggestive or what, but like, yeah, what am I gonna do in the Navy going forward, you know? What else is out there? You know, all these guys were going to business school, getting jobs with, you know, in London. You know, we had a guy on a staff officer get a job with Amazon UK at the time. This is 1999. You know, he ended up being like number eight of the Amazon UK, you know, employee number. You know, so you just, your eyes just got open to like, huh, what else is out there? You know, and then once, you know, and then my wife, she would have been fine staying in the Navy, but you know, I think once she saw like, wait, we can get out and go, you know, go do something else, you know. So I made, yeah, made it a hard decision to get out, you know. So, and this is so the summer of 2000, separated from the Navy, and then from there, I went to business school back to St. Louis and went to, you know, Marshall University in St. Louis, you know, 2-year MBA program, you know. So.
Nice.
Yeah, so in my mind, you know, my operational days were over, you know, wasn't, you know, excited about what's going to be the next 10 years. You know, it was, you know, new and kind of exciting. You know, the world was relatively stable then, you know, in 2000. You know, who would have thought 9/11 would have happened a year later? Yeah, so that's what I did. You know, I ended up going to business school for 2 years, you know, but then, you know, of course, in the next fall, 9/11 happens, and I'm like, you got to be kidding me, you know? Wow, you know. So, but out of business school, I ended up working. I did an internship with 3M in Minnesota, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, you know, 3M, you know, the sandpaper office, you know, post-it notes, you know, company.
Sure, yeah.
Huge, yeah, at the time, $22 billion company, big industrial, you know, manufacturing companies. It was pretty cool. Great technology. You know, they're 3M's kind of internal claim to fame is they have such incredible technology patents that they've left inside on the shelves of the company and kind of forgotten about. That's, you know, they're such a unique, you know, technology development program that they have there. So
Yeah, without a doubt that some young entrepreneur could probably take and make something out of these days,
yeah.
right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that's interesting. And that sort of dovetails right
Yep.
into what Mobius and Mobius Connect are all about with maintenance and reliability training and sort of the key specialties that most veterans sort of come out of service with either maintenance, which even if you're just maintaining a weapon, you're doing, precision maintenance
Yeah.
on gear all the way up through aircraft and nuclear submarines and everything, and operations, really like mission accomplishment. Like, how does the process look end to end? How do we start? How do we finish? How do we retrain? How do we do lessons learned and stuff like that? So this podcast is really focused on maintenance and reliability. So I imagine maintenance and reliability was part of what was going on at the 3M as well. Were you did
Yeah.
you were you integrated into that? Or like, was that the job that you got, or were you in
Yeah, so
manufacturing or operations? Yeah.
I kind of did it all. I went into this like kind of unique internal consulting group that 3M has, a bunch of like MBA students that they bring into
Okay.
the company. You know, kind of a leadership development, you know, company exposure, like 2 to 3 years. And then from there, you get placed into, a business unit or operational unit of the company. So while you're there, you're doing maybe 2 to 3 projects at a time. You might be at a plant, a plastic extrusion plant, in Alabama, trying to find, improve, places for operational improvements, or maybe even, doing internal safety audits, just to, some type of, kind of management consulting type work. You could do be in, do a pricing, pricing project for maybe the office, products group. I did, at the time, 3M owned a company called Scientific Anglers, which is a, anybody who fly fishes knows them really well. You can kind of go and do market development surveys, on the fly fishing community. It was kind of across the board, but it just gave you kind of gave you exposure
Cool.
on the company.
That's something
Yeah.
that people wouldn't necessarily assume
No.
when you talk about 3M fly fishing, right?
Yeah.
That's cool. So you got a lot of experience in that
Yeah.
role, yeah.
What was kind of unique though, being coming from the military, it was kind of an anomaly and, to Minnesota, because it's really, upper Midwest, a majority of their, hires, come from that area. There really wasn't that many, veterans that were in the community, in the company. They were there, but not as much as, you would think. And it would have been great company for, veterans across all services and a bunch of MOSs that would have fit in really nicely there. It's just not on, not just on the mutual radars,
Upper Midwest, very cold. I mean, I don't know. My brain map of the SAC bases is not as complete as it should or could be. But I actually, surprisingly enough, spent 3 years in a staff job out of Fort Snelling in the reserves, right adjacent to the St. Paul Airport, Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. And that was interesting, but I chuckled a little bit when the way you said staff, it was kind of like stuff, staff, right? It's like the fun times are over, and now we're going to meetings and planning and operations and everything like that. Anyway, back to 3M and your experiences there. Did you stay there for a bunch of years, or did you
Yeah, I was
jump
there for
to?
3 years. Yeah,
Okay.
so meanwhile, in parallel, 9/11's happened. We've invaded Iraq, and then now we're in Afghanistan. But when I was in SEAL training, I was in the same buds class as Eric Prince, the guy who started Blackwater. So
Okay.
stayed in touch with him, throughout the years, and then get a call saying, "Hey man, we really need some help. We're growing so fast. We need some structure and some management, and why don't you come on out and take a look?" So now I went back to my wife and said, "Hey, I talked to Eric today, and I'm going to go out and see the Blackwater site and everything." And she's like, "Well, what do you mean by that?" Like, "Oh, just
What are you
yeah, I'm just
doing?
checking it out."
Yeah.
So I, deep down, I think she knew, but I got out there. It's funny, when I was at SDV Team 2, we were probably one of the first SEAL commands to kind of actually use his site at the time for just a training venue. It's because it was 30 minutes down the road, technically. So I went out there. Literally, as I'm pulling in, there's Black Hawks flying across. There's explosions and gunfire out in the horizon. The place was just buzzing, and I'm just like, "Oh, you're kidding me, man." And then also, God, there's a sense of guilt, because I got out before 9/11. And I'm like, "Oh, you got to be kidding me," So to me, that was a great way to kind of get back into the fight, even if, from a reservist perspective, if I would have done, gotten the reserves and, gotten called up, I probably wouldn't have been as close to the fight as I would have with Blackwater. So I ended up in, first told 3M that, hey, I'm leaving, and which is like hardly anyone ever leaves 3M. It's just kind of the culture, they're like,
Right.
what? You can't do that, leaving. And then, I think it was like May, like May 30th, and by June 2nd, I'm on a plane and, heading to Afghanistan, to kind of starting up a new training program to train the Afghan border police or something, so I'm like, okay, all right, this is kind of back into it,
Yeah, well,
feel like
it's
I'm
probably
contributing.
the quickest way to contribute. I mean, I'm here to tell you, through 20 years and being in the reserves for at least probably 10 or 12 of that, there were guys that were begging to go over that couldn't get over. And there were a lot of, I mean, because a lot of patriotic people were doing multiple tours and were in it and doing the thing, but you probably made a wise decision on contribution as quickly as you could have been. So that's fascinating. So yeah, right on. Okay.
So primarily for then that, for the next 12, 13 years, I stayed in that, that defense contracting world. Really got this, full immersion on government contracting, the FAR, the Federal Acquisition Regulations, going through many cycles of putting a proposal together, submitting it, winning or losing, and just kind of seeing how contracting works in the government was, pretty interesting. But also that was kind of the probably the first little nuggets of idea on about Opline, because we would submit a contract and we win it, and they go, okay, it might have been a maybe a an embassy staffing contract, like, hey, you're going to staff, these four embassies with medical, aviation, logistics, and IT people, and you bid on it, and then you get like 60 days to do it, sometimes even, less than that, so you'd have to rely on, our own HR department to go out and find those individuals, and then of course you fall short, and it used to be all of us, all the operational guys, in the 11th hour around a room trying to find individuals and tapping into our own personal networks, looking for these individuals. Like, oh, wait, we need a retired DEA agent who speaks Spanish and he's certified and given polygraph test, something, like that. And you're like,
Obscure.
yeah, but
Yeah.
one of our teammates is a, former DEA guy. Or no, he worked for the DEA at one time. He's like, oh, I know somebody. I know Fernando over there. So he calls Fernando. Fernando hooks us up with the right guy. But you're like, this isn't a way to run a business, man. There's got to be a, a better way. And again, coming from 3M, where everything is so structured and methodical, they have all these processes, and you're like, this is all ad hoc. It's like, you can't sustain this way of life and doing it. So in the back of our mind, we always thought there had to be a better way of doing this, so that
So
was
that
the,
was the genesis of Opline then.
yeah. Yeah. The kind of the anger and frustration we've experienced, one, excitement that we won, but the anger and frustration of not finding these individuals, even though we knew they were right. They were probably in front of us. They were probably at church on Sunday, the next, pew over, or, they're at the, gas station, but you have no idea. So we're like, hey, there's got to be a better way of doing this, so that's kind of, continuously experienced that kind of drove us to like, come on, there's got to be a better way on how we can, automatically align people. We had, our HR group, they would expand and contract on, the needs of the company. They subscribe to all the different job boards out there, the ZipRecruiters, Indeeds, staffing agencies, headhunters, whatever, but we're like, man, it's just, there's got to be a better way. And that's kind of what set us on that path.
So really, really interesting. So, good news is you got the business. The bad news is you got the business. Staffing, right? So this is, to me, hearing this story for the first time, it sounds like, okay, well, using the example of the embassy, you have more or less civilian sort of requirements, right? aviation security, that type of thing. So you're through that process, you're seeing and you're learning how to do that translation for the business that they've so in a pressure cooker of delivery, right? Delivery on the bid and making sure, and then quickly realizing that yes, you have a depth of a network, but you can't, that's not going to sustain you through continuous growth and improvement and all that type of thing. And then looking in, really just looking back at the way the system was, quote, working prior to improvement. And that clearly led you guys to something very much better, which again, I don't know if it's been replicated or even tried. I mean, I've seen the ZipRecruiter, I've seen the LinkedIn stuff. I mean, it's a little bit of a torturous journey on some of these paths if you're really looking for a job, right? If you're really looking for a job, and you can see how veterans feel perhaps misunderstood, and corporations feel misunderstood too by veterans, and if that breaks down, then you've got somebody with high potential future sort of languishing. Right. And even worse, going, getting depressed, getting into booze or whatever, and then just, going down this bad road. So, okay. So that led you to the creation of something new and better. Awesome.
Yeah, and
Okay.
that experience really is, priceless, because we were to a point, because one, you have the U.S. government that has the job description with the requirements, and those requirements are, basically either off. You either have them or you don't. They're black and white. And if you don't have them, you don't get paid. So if you have somebody who requires a college degree, must have this certification, this years of experience, and if you can't prove that, even though that person's been filling that job, the government has all the right and the authority to say, "I'm sorry, I'm not paying you. You didn't meet those requirements." So we got so good at looking, we'd get a stack of resumes from HR. And I could just look and just look at three places and go, yes, don't, no, so we would, be able to burn through because we knew what they were asking for, but that experience led us to know, okay, what are the most critical elements, of a job in that job description, and you got all these poor people who spend so much time and effort writing these resumes, where really all we really need to know is these eight categories with these, do you have these certifications? Do you speak a language? Do you have, what's your education? What's your functional, skills? What's your, subfunction skills? All that, would have never even thought of any of that without being like in the trenches daily, experiencing that.
Well, and kudos to you for doing the work, right? So doing the work, and I'm going to tell you a true story. I don't know where, if the genesis of the story was true, but what I heard from somebody recently who went through job seeking hardships on their own, went in and talked to a person, and they had two stacks of resumes on their desk, maybe 100 in each stack. And they came in and they put their resume on the one stack, and then later they came, they came back to find out what happened. The hiring manager had taken the one stack and put it in the trash without even looking at it, and said, I don't want to hire an unlucky person. So, okay, so you're lucky because your resume is in the one stack versus the other. It doesn't seem like a very scientific method of hiring folks. And really, okay, I get it that people are overwhelmed. They got a lot of stuff to do, but what you have developed and designed is really the way it ought to be done from what I can tell. So if you don't mind describing it, I mean, it's kind of like, I'll use a little bit of a dated reference, but an eHarmony for, job seekers and employers, or, a matchmaker sort of system. So how does it work? How did you develop it from there? Like what came out of it?
So I guess the main key learning takeaway from that experience was we noticed that, the I guess the currency that's used for people to find jobs is a resume and then a job description, and then unfortunately, in the middle is a human that's, you know, from HR who historically, you know, isn't an expert in any of those areas, you know, and they're tasked to kind of like do the filtering, do the, you know, triaging of these resumes, you know, and we're like, yeah, why is that? And it's because it's basically the system's analog, you know, like it's not like any other system, like, you know, logistics has, you know, those ERP systems that automatically can take data and connect everything and do bill of lading and all that kind of stuff. Financial markets are completely digitized, all that, but we're like, man, the largest element of a business, labor, is still kind of analog, and you have this, you know, this very archaic system in the middle that's kind of really slowing things down and you know, causing people to miss each other. You know, they hiring managers at a operational unit contacts HR and go, hey man, I need an engineer with this certification, years of experience, you know, or I need an IT person with software development skills, you know, and so now that department's responsible for going out and finding them. But that gets all that stuff gets lost in translation. And sometimes a hiring manager isn't really good at articulating what the skills are, even though they know what they want when they see it. It's kind of like porn. You know what it is when you see it.
Right. You know? Right. Yeah.
So we're like, okay, what if somehow we can, you know, take that analog nature out of it and digitize it, you know, we're like, all right, well, if you do that, you've got to have a baseline. You got to have a backbone that everything is kind of measured against, you know? So I think the key to our system is, you know, we're like, hey, let's put the labor supply aside right now. You know, then by labor supply, I mean the people with the skills and the, you know, ability to do work, but let's focus on what the labor market asks for. You know, if we can organize, structure, and digitize what the labor market wants, that's our foundation to measure everything else off, you know. And if we create a, you know, nice little user interface that can collect someone's skills, you know, that would allow us to kind of instantly do the alignment. Mm-hmm. And then we can value anybody against a set of jobs. And by a set of jobs, it could be a company set of jobs. You know, if you have an aviation machinist coming out of the military, he's probably very valuable to Boeing, you know, but probably not valuable to Apple, you know, just because, you know, their skills, you know, that kind of thing. So that was kind of like first recognizing that it's that the current system is broke because it's analog, but if we can digitize it, you know, that's like, okay, great. And then by focusing on the demand side, that really kind of broke its back and allowed us to do that. And what we did to test it, you know, like, see, okay, you know, let's run all the government contracting, you know, requirements through that kind of model and see if it works. And it worked. You're like, holy crap. All right. You know, so then we took the time and effort to kind of basically create our own taxonomy of what the labor market looks like. Mm-hmm. You know, so now we can dump any set of labor data, you know, careers, job sites and all that into that system, and the system will now automatically organize it. So you always have this kind of living dynamic picture or map of what the labor market looks like, you know? So now when we bring in a new person, we can like, all right, hey, here's, you know, based on these skill sets, here's all the jobs that you are immediately aligned to. And then we can also do like time, speed, distance from that person. Like, hey, here's all the jobs you align to, but you're not too far off from, you know, you're a software developer, and you are like a year away from being a DevOps guy, you know, a cloud guy, you know, that kind of thing. And then we can tell that person, you know, here's all the skills that are required for all that.
Oh, nice. Okay. So there's a potential development piece there too, guidance, mentoring,
yeah,
tutorial type deal. Fascinating, right? Because you're creating really an index for the civilian world job descriptions that are out there. And okay, so that's sort of the demand side. Now on the labor, on the supply side, especially for veterans, how did you go about coalescing all that?
Yeah. So now, like, if you think of the veterans, it's just, they're the same as any job seeker. They just have another layer of vernacular on top of them, you know? You know, so like, you know, like a Navy health technician, probably 98% of the HR people in the you know, commercial labor market have no idea what a hull technician is, you know. But we went through every MOS, every NEC, every Air Force specialty code, and we kind of associated their equivalent to the labor market to kind of start the alignment with, you know. So now when the machine sees a hull technician and knows, oh man, that guy's an HVAC welder type guy, he should have these skill sets. We ask him, hey, do you have these skill sets? And he just points and clicks. And now he has a signature of what he can or she can possibly do. And then it automatically gets translated and delivered to a company that's looking for that type of person. And now the HR person doesn't even have to worry about a health technician. They just know that this person aligns to the jobs that they have.
So fantastic. So in my example, two stacks of 100 resumes,
yeah,
that, I mean, how long would it take to basically, if you had those resumes all digitized, right? I guess that's how you do it, or yeah, how would you do it? So if I was coming in Eric Bovino and I said, okay, I have my resume, would you say, all right, go on the offline site and list all your Navy, yep, skills, maybe your corporate skills, and that's the best way to do it? Or do you actually take like a PDF resume and have the AI parse it and look for things? And
yeah, we, at the beginning, yeah, when we started this journey, like almost 7 years now, we try to do the resume ingestion thing, and it's just, there's so much noise and chaos and all, mm-hmm, those resumes. We're like, let's get rid of that. Let's do the best we can and create a very simple point and click, clever way of collecting their skills, you know, that are important, you know. So we would say, hey, we don't want your resume. Go here. Tell us who you are, what you know, how many years experience you have. And then we're going to present you a list of skills that you probably have, you know. So they're basically kind of building an online skills profile, you know, and then that pretty much creates their signature. And that's the, and that would have, and we would be able, we could tell that hiring manager with that 100 resumes, all right, all these people now are in your upline system, and we rank them for you against your job sets, you know.
Right. And that person with the two stacks wouldn't have to do the work, right? I mean, yeah, just the only work would be like, okay, you want to work here, go to the site, create your profile, and, you know, there you go. Yeah. And
that's why
I
feel so bad for, especially the guys coming out of, you know, the TAP program, the Transition Assistance Program. You know, I think it's 2 weeks long. They spend at least 2.5 days on resume writing. You're like, you know, it's just like, no, man, it's your wait. You just wasted 2.5 days. Eventually you're going to need a resume for the hire, for the, you know, company HR to put into their, you know, higher, you know, whatever compliance, you know, reasons.
Right.
You know, but
I mean, it almost sounds like resumes as we know it may end up becoming obsolete,
yeah,
you know, to some degree, because I mean, how many of them are bullshit too, right? I mean,
yeah,
there's so much craft now in resume writing. Not that it's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, you want to have a good, great representation,
right,
of what you can do. But at least in my most recent experience in corporate America, we would never hire anybody just on a resume. I mean, a phone, yeah, screening, and not even just a typical roundtable interview. I mean, they had to like come in from a sales and marketing perspective. They actually had to, you know, present a pitch, like, you got to show us what you're going to do. So,
yeah, exactly.
So I love the fact that your system can take ingestion from the job seeker, and you can also, so are you taking, you know, say a corporate person, the corporate HR person is listening to this podcast and they want to get involved, but they submit their job descriptions to you, and then that those would be parsed, or do they have to do some sort of similar type work as the applicant?
We do it automatically. They, you know, we scrape probably on a nightly basis. We scrape like 10,000 companies or more career pages. You know, the machine has seen over 10 million job descriptions. So it already, gone through and knows when it sees a, a job posting, what it is, and it categorizes it and lists it and codes it all up,
And there's probably similarities in structure and format that most people use. Yeah.
And let's say, my example I like to give, let's say an accountant, we've seen every job requirement that's listed in, hundreds of thousands of accountant job postings. You could take each one of those and parse them down to like, all right, here's the top eight that are always asked in accountant job postings, so it's been distilled and sensitized to, to that. So by doing that, we capture 90% of all accountant job postings.
Well, you may even upgrade some postings for people that they don't even know it, right? You're incorporating a little larger scale of what's out there.
There's been some doozies. I mean, companies aren't really good at writing job descriptions, tons of cut and paste, so that we can help them write better job descriptions. Like, hey, what you really want is this type of skill. You're like, oh, yeah, that's what we want. Yeah.
Right on, right on. So you said you've been doing it for 7 years now. So what is sort of like the profile of, let's start with the demand side first on the companies that are using, like who does the best with like super big companies, medium, small, certain number seeking like jobs that they're seeking to fill every year. Like what makes a great candidate for a customer of yours?
Yeah. Right now we have 10 Fortune 100 companies using it, really good. They have these kind of, robust veteran hiring programs, so they kind of fit in their resource and they're budgeted, but then it's go down, we have a handful of small companies and mid-size across, all different industries, the companies that use it and embrace it and like use it into their, talent acquisition strategy do very well. Companies that just want to use it as a sourcing, platform and kind of use it every once in a while, usually, don't renew or something, kind of thing. But, Boeing's been our customer since January 1st. They've told us that we've reduced their cost to hire per veteran by 75%. We're like, wow, okay. But that was a company that really embraced it. They set up kiosks at job fairs and people come in and just do the skills ingestion side. And their recruiters emails, they list, a link to their upline, link on their page. They've really embraced it and it's paying off. The other problem is our biggest obstacle is kind of the traditional archaic HR nature. The leadership kind of sometimes sees this like, wow, this is very valuable. And it trickles down to, the recruiters and they're just kind of, not forced to use it, but they just never use it. They're like, oh, great, another tool, So our challenge is to make sure we can train them as much as possible and show them the value, but we can get over that, it'll be great adoption.
No, without a doubt, it seems like it'd be a lot more efficient for people who really are truly dedicated to seeking out veterans, right? And have that as part of their program. And maybe even as a follow on for this, Jeff, if you have anybody that you want to nominate from any of your customer companies, especially within the roles of maintenance reliability, if they have manufacturing plants or airframe plants or, power plants or whatever to, to come on here and to talk about how they do their program too, because I think a natural segue beyond helping people use the tools that are available to them to find the right next match for their employment or their career is to really understand which organizations are adopting veteran friendly practices, have an employee relations group and all that type of thing, which, you know, I know that it's not necessarily as popular these days, and it's perhaps viewed with some derision in the political climate. But I'm here to tell you, I mean, as a veteran participating in the affinity groups, it was great, right? Because everybody's looking for community. And if the community within the organization you work in is not necessarily the type of community or not close-knit, and you're looking for that, then, you know, finding it with your veteran peers is something special. So,
yeah, I was going to tell you too. Yeah. We just started a pilot program with the Manufacturing Institute Association.
So, awesome. Okay.
Yeah. I think there might be some connection there with Mobius somehow. I don't know what it is, but it kind of makes sense. But the program would be, you know, they would have, the Institute would have our, you know, candidate links on their site, you know, so veterans can click on it. And then because of their member, you know, their 1,000 members, you know, we can take that skills profile and automatically push it out to all 1,000 member companies, you know, so now that candidate will get exposed to all the companies in that Institute, you know, trade association, you know, instead of trying to go to each different one. So we're trying to see how that plays out. But, you know, again, if it's the if it's the machinist mate, you know, coming, he can go to that institute, create a profile, then it automatically gets syndicated to all those companies, and now they know he's out there, you know. And ideally, they would see him and go, "Oh, ideally, he'd get like 10 calls in the next 24 hours, you know. But we're going to see how that works out.
Oh, that sounds great. And the immediate association that comes to my mind is the Society of Maintenance and Reliability Professionals of SMRP, which is really big in the maintenance. So we can make those connections with you guys too. And really, I think finding a company like Opline for veterans, you mentioned the TAP, the transition classes, heavy emphasis on resume writing and stuff like that. I mean, finding Opline may be like finding a needle in a haystack for some veterans, right?
Yeah.
So if we can put out the word here and make it at least a bigger needle in that haystack, then
awesome.
we'll be in good shape. Well, with respect to your time, Jeff, I just have a couple more questions here just to make sure that we cover them, and then we'll start to wrap things up. But what advice would you give to any service member planning to transition to the civilian world that you wish you had when you made that move?
Yeah. I mean, one, it's, you always get the advice about, you know, networking, you know, and I think it's, that networking advice is great for like, or well, maybe it's more well received that maybe some of the, you know, senior officers, senior enlisted who have it, but it's, you know, I'm more worried about the E3, E45, who really don't, they don't have a network, but they kind of do. And, you know, not to, you know, not to discount it at all, you know.
not to discount their, no, I mean, their buddies that have been through similar stuff, and they're out there. I mean, just catching up with them to see what they're doing is a great idea.
Yeah. Those are, you know, 11 Bravos, infantry guys in the Army. You know, a lot of them ahead of them have gotten out. God, reach out to them, you know, like, hey, man, where are you? What are you doing? And, you know, it's just, you know, kind of picking up the phone or texting and asking, you know. So,
well, hey, 10 out of 10 people, you got 10% chance of finding somebody that may be at a place where they've landed, they love it, and they're looking for more people like them, right?
So, yep, exactly.
Fantastic. Great advice. And any other guidance that you can share with corporate hiring managers about veterans that they need to know to get the best military fits for the positions they're seeking to fill?
Yeah. I mean, Opline plug. I mean, we can, you know, automate a lot of that up, you know, upstream, top of the funnel, you know, type stuff. So they can spend more time, more quality time with candidates, you know. I think, you know, too many great candidates get passed over just because of these rote kind of archaic analog systems. So there's tools out there, but I know, and I also know it's frustrating because they probably get hit up all the time by all these other, companies with a new system, but there's some good ones out there.
Well, yeah, for sure. But you guys are, by practitioners for practitioners. I mean, you came from the service. You did military or government contracting, seeking military skill sets and all that. And you guys have done the work to have a very unique, what I consider a very unique program. I mean, maybe there are more out there, but yeah, I absolutely. I mean, OPLIGN.com.
Sorry, it's really it's concatenation of opportunities alignment. But it was more important that we had a six digit URL.
Right on. Okay.
That goes a long way for some
We don't
reason.
have to go into the details of why that is, but yeah, I want to make sure people can find it if they're looking for it. And correct me if I'm wrong, but for service members to create a profile, it's no cost,
All
right?
free.
All free,
All
right?
free. Our business model is solely based on companies paying us and everyone else benefits.
Right on. Right on. Okay, so anything
Nice.
we didn't cover today that we need to relate to listeners, either vets or those looking to connect with them?
Just one more initiative we got going on. It's going to be Small Business Veteran America. So any veteran-owned small business can tap into our network for free.
Oh.
Just because that I think that's the way what we're trying to do. Like you alluded to it earlier. There's lots of great jobs out there, but not many people know about it. Small businesses just get pushed down to the wayside. So we want to give them a tool, that they can tap into, the veteran network for free, but then veterans get to see all these small businesses, maybe in their hometown, kind of thing. So, and it's on our website. It's called SBVA, Small Business Veteran America. We just got, there's a bank called Old Glory Bank that's kind of partnering with us on that one.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a great way for us to kind of connect the small businesses with the veterans coming out and find gainful employment, because that's where all those best jobs are, in my opinion. But
Well, without a doubt, and there's so many veterans who feel like that they were, so busy and so stressed, and it's all true, right? The military has a way of putting as much on you as you can handle, and they come out and they're just like gung ho and nothing, no jobs appear, no jobs appear, no jobs appear. Well, I can do it, and I'm going to start up my own business. So, I mean, for those that have started their own thing, they can take advantage of this, or you're the employers that. Well, yeah, veterans who've started their own thing, veteran-owned businesses, and the folks, getting like-minded people. It just does, right, wrong, or indifferent, it just does make it easier if you're speaking the same language and you're all operating like a team, and the right hand knows what the left hand's doing. I mean, it's just so inefficient to have a group of people that don't understand each other together, and it's tough, makes it harder. So. Right on. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Jeff. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me and help us on this mission. How can folks get a hold of you if they want to learn more? Is it LinkedIn? Is that the best way to go, or?
LinkedIn, or my email is easy. It's Jeff, JEFF at opline.com, OPLIGN.com. So
You guys are email minimalists and nice. I love it. Come from somebody, richard.bevavino@blahblahblah.com. I mean, that's a lot to type. So, yeah. All right. So, before we close out, I'd like to give a couple short notes to our listeners. First, I want to personally invite you to join us in Milwaukee in September of 2025, the 8th and 9th, for Mobius Connect Live. It's a one-of-a-kind event packed with real-world applications and valuable connections with fellow CVM practitioners and reliability professionals. I'll be hosting a special live episode of Veterans Connected at that event. This is a unique opportunity for us to come together, share stories, learn from each other, and dig into what it means to be a veteran in today's industry. So mark your calendars and register now. I can't wait to see you there in Milwaukee. Secondly, to round out our show, we're seeking more female veterans as well as recently transitioned vets. If you know former service members that would be interested in telling us their stories, please send them our way. So finally, Jeff, thank you. And thank you, Mobius, for providing us this platform to help both transitioning vets as well as those looking to hire them in the field of maintenance and reliability. That's it. Thank you, Jeff.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Veterans Connected. We will see you back for another episode very soon. In between, we hope to see you in the Veterans Connected community group where you can meet Eric and fellow podcast guests and share with other industry veterans at MobiusConnect.com. And we hope to see you there.